If you don't know what your triggers are, if you don't know what your strengths and limitations are, if you don't know what your blind spots are, you really can't lead effectively and live a balanced, integrated life, in my view. And so that's where I feel self-awareness is really foundational.
Welcome to ICAN, a podcast about ophthalmology through a uniquely Canadian lens with Dr. Mona Dagher and myself, Dr. Hadi Saheb.
Bienvenue à ICAN, un balado sur l'ophtalmologie sous un angle typiquement canadien avec le Dr. Hadi Saheb et moi-même, Dr. Mona Dagher.
Season 4 of the ICAN podcast is brought to you by Bayer Ophthalmology. We thank them for their support. Nous aimerions remercier Bayer Ophthalmology pour leur support de la quatrième saison du balado ICAN.
We will share our experiences as ophthalmologists today and tackle some of the challenges we face as healthcare providers. Hey there, eye care enthusiasts. It's Mona and...
Hadi, back at it again with ICAN.
You know it, Hadi. Today's episode is going to be a real eye-opener. Pun intended.
Mona, always with the puns. I promise, folks, today's discussion will be just as sharp as Mona's great wit.
Hey, we're here to keep it both informative and entertaining, right?
Absolutely. So whether you're a seasoned ophthalmologist or just as fascinated by eyes as we are, you're in for a treat. On this episode of ICAN, we discuss what it means to be a physician leader. From empowering younger physicians to become leaders to what doctors should know about leadership. And our guest is Dr. Nina Ahuja. Dr. Nina Ahuja was born in Timmins, Ontario, and raised on the property of a gold mine in neighboring small town South Porcupine. When she graduated high school, she moved down south, where she completed her undergraduate degree at University of Waterloo. From there, studies led her to McMaster University for medical school and then University of Ottawa, where she completed residency in ophthalmology. She then began her surgical practice in Hamilton in 2003. With a passion for teaching, Dr. Ahuja was a key contributor in establishing the ophthalmology residency program at McMaster University, a program that began in 2005.
Over the years, she has won numerous awards for excellence in teaching and for contributions to residency education as past program director, academic division head for ophthalmology, and president of the Association of Canadian University of Professors of Ophthalmology, ACUPO. In 2023, she was recognized for her outstanding contributions by the Canadian Ophthalmological Society as recipient of the esteemed Women in Ophthalmology Champion for Change Award. Dr. Ahuja is currently a national examiner for the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada.
So Nina, thanks for joining us tonight and welcome back to ICAN.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
So on the topic of leadership, I think most of us feel like leadership is not like a position you apply for, like to become an ophthalmologist or to become an accountant. And, you know, leadership is also not always decided by the person. You know, often you're perceived as a leader. And so I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about, you know, how and when you decided to pursue a leadership role and what inspired you to go down that path?
You know, that's a great question. And what you say is very true, that oftentimes we don't pick leadership, but leadership picks us. And that was very much the case in my journey. When I started practice in Hamilton in 2003, there was no residency program. I was brought in with a faculty appointment, knowing that the vision was to establish a residency program. It was just in the phases of reinstating it at the time that I joined. With that, because I came in with a faculty appointment, the role into leadership just happened, so that when the program was established, I really had a passion for surgery and developing surgical curriculum for the residency program, and therefore became the director of cataract surgical teaching. So the leadership journey started there by the fact that I was present, I was interested, and I wanted to give back because I really appreciate what my mentors did for me. And that's when the journey started. Over the course of my career, though, it evolved simply by opportunities coming my way. And one of the things that is very common is that we're often given leadership roles because of what we've done clinically or because of what we've done research-wise, and yet we don't always have formalized training in leadership. that's something that I was fortunate to have mentors along the way, but I also saw that there are different capabilities in leadership abilities between physicians because we don't have formal training. And so that's where I think one of the challenges comes into play, where we're offered these opportunities, but we don't necessarily have the competencies in a conscious development way to really be able to be effective in those roles.
And was there a moment in your training or even in your early years where you said, you know, I think I can thrive as a leader and as a mentor for younger ophthalmologists or trainees? Was there that aha moment, or did you feel it was, you know, truly organic and gradual?
It's interesting. When I reflect back, I always had a tendency of wanting to educate. So part of my core identity, I really truly connect with, is being an educator. When I was in grade 8, going all the way back to elementary school, I used to go to the high school to do grade 9 math. And in fact, my grade 8 teachers had put together a core group of 6 students where I then became the advanced math teacher. So that part was there. It kind of alienated me with amongst my friends, but it was very good experience. And I developed a lot of different skills that way. So I think early on, I saw the impact that I could have by helping other people learn certain concepts and help them develop. And then in high school, I was very involved in different activities. I think like many of us, most of us are generally involved in extracurricular activities like student council. I was co-president of student council when I was in my final year. And so with those things, I was very excited about being able to be involved in different initiatives and bring different activities and things to our school. That insight from the beginning, I think, was there. And so whenever there was an opportunity that came up, it was something that I was really excited about pursuing. So I think that from early on, it was sort of a seed that was sowed and then developed over time.
So interesting. And I'm listening to what you were saying about being an integral part of building your residency program. And I'm amazed by that because, you know, I'm at McGill, and just running a cruise control residency program that's already established takes so much time and energy. And I can't even imagine how much time and energy it took to build a program from scratch. So, you know, there you were being likely a busy clinician with a whole clinical practice to manage, and then putting this time and energy into helping build a residency program. How did you feel you were able to balance your clinical responsibilities with your leadership duties as well?
One of the things that I truly believe in is collaboration. So that in building that residency program that was spearheaded under Dr. John Harvey, who was our academic division head at the time. And we had a number of faculty members who were also involved in building different aspects of the program. So that I think if you have a collaborative spirit, you're able to talk about issues and concerns, delegate tasks and distribute responsibilities so that you can then be more balanced in focusing your clinical work. Now, as I progressed and then had more senior leadership roles where it was more directing a team or collaborating with a team as the leader, the challenges are different. The time demands are different as well. So that in those aspects, it was really about prioritizing what I felt most connected with and then adjusting my clinical load accordingly. There was a period where I was full-time clinic as well as doing these leadership roles on the side. That polarized me quite a bit. I think we all fall into that trap because we want to do everything everywhere and we want to do it in the best way. But I realized over time that that's simply not sustainable, maybe for a certain period. And so to really be able to thrive and to be able to contribute in the way that I wanted to contribute, I had to decide consciously that, okay, let's pick and choose. What do I want to focus on? What do I want to pull back on? What do I connect with most? And then with that, make decisions that would then guide the nature of my practice and how I move forward.
That certainly takes a lot of insight. What do you think are the key qualities you believe every physician leader should possess?
I think you hit the key word, is I think having insight. I think that that self-awareness piece is absolutely essential. The challenge that I experienced and I've seen in people that I've mentored as well, though, is that we're so busy and we get so caught up in the race of everything that we're doing because we are doing so many things that it's very hard to take a pause and just sit and reflect on, you know, what is it that I'm doing? What am I feeling? What do I like doing? What don't I like doing? And then moving forward in a conscious way. And I think I've said that word 3 times already, because I really do believe that moving our awareness into the conscious space of what we're doing becomes really key in being able to balance, being able to be an effective leader, If you don't know what your triggers are, if you don't know what your strengths and limitations are, if you don't know what your blind spots are, you really can't lead effectively and live a balanced, integrated life, in my view. And so that's where I feel self-awareness is really foundational.
I like that a lot. And I wonder if we can unpack a little bit and if I can put you on the spot and ask if you can think of an example where you had this moment or you had to take a step back and have that self-awareness to say, oh, I feel like I need to change directions here because of, you know, XYZ regarding self-awareness. Do you have any examples that come to mind where you had to do that?
Yes. In fact, I have a very concrete example from recent times, in fact. So I've been a very busy clinician, heavy into education, heavy into academic leadership, clinical leadership. That's been part of my journey, and I've really enjoyed it. In those experiences, as I mentioned before, I had noticed different leadership capabilities from different leaders. I felt that there was a lack of formalized education in leadership development and wellness for our medical trainees. And so I had established an organization to deliver this type of material. That's been gaining a lot of momentum. It's called Docs and Leadership. That's been gaining a lot of momentum. And I've been finding that balancing clinical with home, with family, with this initiative that's gaining momentum, I had to make a major shift because I was finding that every time I'd gain momentum on one thing, whether it would be clinically or in this initiative, it would be two steps back because the other would get very, very busy. And so recently I've actually completely restructured my practice. I'm pulling back to very part-time so that I can actually move forward with this other initiative because I really believe in it and I believe in the need of it. That was a really challenging journey to go through. There were certain circumstances that happened that pushed me in that direction. I initially took a sabbatical, was trying to arrange some clinical support with that. Unfortunately, there were challenges with that. And so while it was challenging at the time, I was very grateful for it at the moment because that circumstance really made me take a step back and say, okay, this is what I've done over the last 20, 25 years in my career. This is what I feel proud about. This is what I feel I've learned. And so this is a new opportunity and a new phase for a transition where I can still contribute surgically by maintaining that, but I can really contribute on this other side that I feel is going to hopefully be quite impactful and I'm seeing momentum with it. So I really needed to wrestle with my identity in it and say, what is my priority? What do I want to accomplish? What impact do I want to have? And so with that, the decision was to completely restructure my practice. So that was definitely a moment and a very concrete example of my having to really take a step back. And in fact, the changes will be implemented within the next 6 weeks. And so then I shift more into the other space with clinical being very part-time. The interesting thing is the definition of leadership has shifted for me when I reflect on it as well. So that in earlier in my career, it was about success. I want to get to the next thing. How can I contribute? It's almost like you're accumulating those credentials or that experience or those accolades that you feel will take you to the next level. And then as I've progressed through, I've now hit a point where those things have been wonderful and they've really established a foundation. But now I find I'm shifting more towards what long-term impact do I want to have? What legacy do I want to leave? And so I think that that experience of stopping, reflecting, making those priority decisions, and then pivoting whichever direction you need to go in evolves over time so that you have to kind of honor where you're at in whatever stage and then go with it at that point.
Thanks for sharing that. Wow. Going to shift gears a little bit to managing teams as a leader. And, you know, sometimes are happy times and others are not. And I'm wondering how in both good times and challenging times, how have you tried to foster collaboration and teamwork amongst the team of people that you're leading?
What's really important to me is the mindset as a leader when you're dealing with teams. The definition of a leader to me is someone who is trying to really optimize and maximize the performance of the people on your team so that you have this overall mandate. And yet your objective as a leader is to understand your team members, to understand what they are interested in, what they feel they can contribute, and what their ideas are, and then to pull it all together so that you end up with this overall goal, and yet you're able to bring different pieces of the puzzle together so that everyone's doing something that they're excited about, and yet it's an overall collaboration. That's where I find that being aware of your own strengths and weaknesses becomes really important, because you then are able to help facilitate other people in identifying where they have strengths and weaknesses and blind spots. And then you can sort of direct and put those pieces of the puzzle together so that it really does form a nice whole. I feel that that's really important. And that's where the mindset of I'm here to optimize your performance and make it so that it's a shared effort, that we all feel empowered and some ownership towards the project. Those are the things that I feel really do help teams come together and work very collaboratively in both challenging and in positive times.
Have you found that in some of your initiatives that there are always parts of the work that need to be done that nobody wants to do? And can you share a little bit more about how you've approached those situations? You know, like, you got five members on the team, each of them have strengths, you kind of allocate some of the work to them based on their strengths. And then, you know, out of, let's say, 10 tasks that need to get done to move the initiative to the next level, there's still four left that, you know, don't necessarily align with anybody's strengths but need to get done. Have you had similar experiences, and what have you done in those situations that can be quite tough as a leader?
Yeah, absolutely. In a number of years ago, I can't remember exactly when it was, at our hospital, we were shifting to electronic medical records for our surgical area. That was something that we were very concerned about because, of course, change is very stressful. I was the physician lead representing ophthalmology outpatient surgery at that time. I basically was one who directed things. However, I also did do a lot of the work that people didn't want to do. And I say that cautiously because I don't think that you should be taking up everything that people don't want to do. I think that there are reasons people don't want to do things, and there are advantages sometimes to taking on some of those tasks. So I've got the two perspectives. On the one hand, you don't want to take on all the work because you can't do everything, and part of leadership is learning to delegate. But at the same time, there are certain advantages. So in that particular example, it was really about collaborating with some of the other teams. It was a very interprofessional approach that I had used, where I spoke to the nursing team and I said, okay, so what is it that you would want to know in these templates that would be created from the surgery side, and where do we integrate and how does that come together from your perspective? Then I went to the IT team and I said, okay, so this is what I think would work well for us as surgery, as surgeons, from an efficiency standpoint. How does that fit for you? And then it was also for medical records. And what information do you need to know for billing purposes so that when you're applying for QVP funding or you're submitting your numbers, what helps with that? So that sometimes it's valuable to be the hub where you're addressing all the spokes in the situation and then utilizing each spoke in a very specific way. So for example, I had gone to the subspecialists and I said, please submit your templates. These are the things that you must include. And so that became delegated. Then when that came back, I would review it. And so because I was the central hub, I was able to make sure that everything was, you know, all the checks and balances were there. And there was some identifiable owner of the task so that if there were concerns that arose, it was basically like, okay, you can come talk to me and then I can go to whoever in that on that wheel needs to be addressed or approached, and then we can work it out. So I think that the devil really is in the details. I get phrases wrong often. I hope I got that one right. but it really is, if you miss those small key points, sometimes everything can fall apart, because those are sometimes the elements that really are what make things smooth and efficient. And as the leader, ultimately you're accountable. So that, in my view, to at least have a view on those details is extremely important. And if nobody else wants to pick it up, I will pick it up, simply because then in that sense, you can ensure that things are cohesive and are going to flow through. Now, you have to be balanced about it as well, because you don't want to disempower your team members, and allocate and delegate where you think that it can be managed. But I think the truth of the matter is that as a leader, there will be things that you need to take on. And I personally think that that's not a bad thing at all. I think there are a lot of positives to that as well, since you can really have your pulse on the project and where it's at.
Right. And as a leader, how do you navigate challenges and conflicts within your team or within an organization? How do you deal with rivalry, things that are difficult to usually address?
For myself, I believe in communicating directly to the person where the conflict is at. And I think the biggest thing with conflict management, in my view, is to approach the circumstances and situations with the intent to understand the other person. I don't believe that people are wanting to instigate conflict for fun. I don't think people generally like conflict. It's a stressful scenario. There's usually something behind it. So that my approach has always been, okay, I hear what you're saying. Can you explain your perspective to me more so that I understand where you're coming from? Because this is my understanding of it. Explain if you could share your understanding, and then let's see if there's a common ground. I think that everybody has different perspectives. And also we need to recognize that everyone is viewing circumstances from their own lens, so that we've all had our experiences. Those experiences impact how we receive comments, how we receive ideas, and then also how we express ideas. So that being aware that everyone is looking at it from their own lens and often has a new perspective to add, and there are benefits to differences, that can really help balance the playing field, make people feel comfortable about sharing their experiences and perspectives so that we can come to something that can work for us both or all of us and move forward with a common ground, but with just with more ideas on the playing field.
And in your opinion, what is the biggest challenge facing physician leaders today?
I think the biggest challenge is that we're becoming more polarized, in my view. There are certain policies that are coming forward. We're moving more towards privatization. We're also in an area of limited resources when it comes to finances, when it comes to human resources. We've got more patients that need care. We've got fewer specialists and physicians, surgeons, healthcare providers to be able to provide that care. We've got demands at home as well. We're busy people. We're high achievers. It's our identity as well. There are so many internal and external challenges, opportunities, and strings that pull us in all sorts of different directions. I think that maintaining balance within those polarized states is a real challenge right now. And without the support and the guidance and the education on how to actually do that, it's basically you're trying to navigate it in a way that's not really structured. And I think that also makes it difficult because we tend to be structured people. And, if you're in chaos, that's all the more stressful.
ICANN wants to know what you think. Please send your comments on today's episode or any suggestions you may have for topics or features to communications@cos-sco.ca. And we will try to incorporate them into future episodes.
Hi, I'm Samir Jabour, and I listen to the ICANN podcast.
I wanted to touch on mentorship a little bit, and I feel like over the years there's been more and more programs offering mentorship support to learners. I see them in various programs across the country. The COS has a nice mentorship program for medical students. And it's always felt to me that it's useful for learners. And I'm wondering what you feel the impact is, and if you have any comments about the concrete impact for learners of mentorship programs.
I believe mentorship is extremely important. Mentorship for me has been extremely valuable throughout my career. I was very fortunate to have mentorship as I started my practice, as well as, of course, in my education and residency and whatnot. The benefit of mentorship to learners really is about understanding how to navigate situations where they can leverage the experience of those who've done it before and who've surpassed it. So it's almost like you can't teach what you haven't transcended, and you don't know what you haven't transcended. So that the role of a mentor is to really provide that insight to learners. I think from a concrete standpoint, there are different measurable outcomes that are of value when it comes to mentorship. Well-being is certainly one. If you look at physician or learner well-being indices, where there are some validated tests, there are definitely improvement in scores when it comes to that. If you're looking at also the patient satisfaction scores when patients, when learners are going through their clinical rotations and having interactions with patients, that there's definitely an impact on quality there. I think that the general well-being of learners is important, and I don't mean from simply just a mental health standpoint, but physical as well. If you're looking at psychosocial as well, there are different elements to well-being. There's some measurable indices there. And then also, I think that when you're going into practice, if you're looking at guidance from people who have been in practice for years, even from an economic standpoint, there's an impact because you can actually learn from the experience of those who've set up a practice, for example. What's the best way to go about that? How should you be managing your team? How should you be hiring your team? How do you minimize turnover? How do you maximize satisfaction of your employees? There are so many benefits to mentorship that I'm very happy to see that this is becoming more formalized in a lot of programs. And that's the basis of a lot of the programs that I'm doing in my initiative as well. I think that there's a power of that from a practical standpoint, and then also just from a community standpoint of being able to toss ideas around and talk to each other and exchange experiences and lessons learned.
And on the topic of mentorship, what advice would you give to aspiring physicians who hope to become leaders one day?
My biggest piece of advice is to be open-minded and to recognize that people who have walked the path, they do have experiences and insights that are valuable. It may seem that many of us are old school. I still take notes in a notepad. I don't necessarily use my phone or my laptop all the time. But, you know, there are benefits to that too. So while some of us may seem old school, there are lessons to be learned. And I think, you know, there's the mentee-mentor relationship is a very reciprocal relationship. So that I think as mentors also, we need to be open to learning. But for mentees, I would say be willing to listen to your mentor's experiences and processes. So if you're joining a practice, learn their processes. It doesn't mean you can't change them. But if someone's been in practice for 20 years, there's probably a reason why they've settled on certain processes. They probably work for them since they've been doing it for so long and they figured it out. And then take that and then look at why and understand the whys of why those processes are the way they are, and then take it and make it your own. But I think if you walk into a situation and you feel as though you already know what you're going to be asking and you already know what the answer is, not because you know what the mentor is going to say, but you already have an answer in your head that you can't let go of, it's a disservice to yourself. I think that maintaining an open mind is really key.
And on that same topic, so how do you promote a culture of continuous learning and improvement within your organization?
I feel it's really important for the leaders themselves to be engaged in ongoing education and to be open about it. I think that role modeling is very, very important. And that's one of the reasons why I think we need to have this formalized development so that we, again, coming back to being consciously aware of things, that we are consciously aware that by the position that we are in, by the impact that we have, that by the exposure that we have to our trainees, we are by our actions demonstrating and teaching in everything that we do. So that if we are ourselves pursuing continuing education, that is demonstrating that you don't have to know it all, you will never know it all, and you shouldn't know it all because there's always something to grow on and something to improve. And so if we can demonstrate that as leaders, I believe that that will actually just transcend and translate into something that should be an ongoing activity for everybody.
You know, I want to unpack those comments a little bit and share not a specific example, but something that's come up a few times over the years, which is one, a difference in generations between the three of us and current learners, and two, just a difference in personality. Somebody you might be mentoring just has a different, you know, core values or a different approach to managing conflict or dealing with their teachers. And so as a resident, I felt like my role was to learn as much as I can and to work within the system that I had and make the most of it without necessarily changing it. And partly out, you know, being timid or wanting to, you know, just not create conflict. And I do feel like the current generation of learners, and I admire this aspect of their approach to things, are more willing to challenge the system and quote unquote fight to make things better. But the truth is that a lot of their supervisors or teachers are part of an older generation where that is not the norm or that is not as acceptable. And it's harder for them to understand that approach of challenging the system in a significant way. So I'm wondering if any of your mentees over the years have come to you with a situation where they wanted to challenge the system and you could just tell that it was going to be an uphill battle for them. Mm-hmm. But you believed in their passion to make things better and you believed their intentions to make things better. How have you advised them, right? Because maybe you would have done things differently, you know, 15 years ago when you were a trainee, but today's a different world and our trainees are different than we are. And I'm wondering how you've addressed trainees who have wanted to challenge the system and you believed in their intention, but worried about the uphill battle they would face.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And I've been in that situation a number of times. An example I can give is I deal with groups of residents at different institutions. So this isn't limited to McMaster where I am. So I've seen this a number of times. An example is residents having electives pulled from their schedule and them being very concerned about not having enough time to be able to go to different programs to experience whether or not they're interested in a certain fellowship. There's resistance from the program because they were mandated to have X number of weeks and X number of rotations. And therefore, the best way to be able to really address the manpower issues or the person power issues in the program was to decrease the number of electives and to redistribute time. That was something that the residents and I worked through, and it actually came to a positive outcome. The way that that happened and the way that I guided them and the way that I guide all resident groups when they're having something like this is to look at it from both sides. One of the things that I found is that when there's frustration on the resident side, it's really because they're looking at their own experience. And I think the age and stage that they're at, that's normal because you're looking at, you know, here I am in a residency program. I don't want to rock the boat. There's the hidden curriculum we all know about. I'm really upset about this, though. I want this opportunity. This is going to impact my career. And I'm really frustrated. This is adding to my stress. I can't concentrate because I'm losing opportunities. This is my life. And it goes on and on and on. All valid points. But you get so caught up in the chaos of that and the emotion of that, that it's very hard to pull back and say, okay, there's another side. So that there's this polarity of intellect that is really centered in the resident experience, as it should be because they're residents. However, by increasing their awareness of the faculty position, so the other side of that polarization, it's become a situation and a problem-solving exercise where the residents are actually able to explore and understand why things are coming forward so that they understand the intention. It's not to take away, it's either dealing with the resource issue or dealing with the faculty, accessibility or availability situation, or that there's some other standard or some other regulation that's come forward that's putting them in this position. So that the way that I'll often have the residents approach it is, okay, let's look at this from both sides. And I have a framework that I work through. It's the ADMIT framework. And you go through, okay, the different stages and where are your challenges? And then how do we look at the polarization and how do we bring it together? So as an example, with the electives, okay, so what is it do you think that the program director is facing, that they're feeling this pressure to have to change the schedule? What challenges do you think that person is facing? And what challenge do you think that the REC or the residency program committee is facing? And why do you think that they've come to this as a solution? What other solutions do you have that may actually address their concerns? Do you think that these are feasible solutions? And then for your own perspective as a resident, what is it that you're willing to accept? What is that position that, you know, this would be your ideal, but this would be acceptable? And then how can we bridge it so that the faculty are able to move forward and you're able to move forward and come together so that there's less polarization? And what I found in those experiences is that the residents gain an appreciation for the faculty perspective because we're all trying to uphold standards. We're mandated to. And so that comes into play. And then the residents understand their position, obviously, because they're in their position, but they gain an appreciation for the complexities that are involved. That, along with having a faculty advocate, then becomes very helpful, either behind the scenes offering guidance or which I did in one particular case at one institution, and at another institution, it was basically saying, okay, we're doing this as a formal workshop. Therefore, I will prepare a summary, present it to the postgrad dean or present it to the program director or whatever level we're dealing with, and say, this is the feedback that's been given, so that it neutralizes the concern of the hidden curriculum issue. Meanwhile, it allows the residents to feel heard. And then both instances, it's actually brought faculty and residents together so that everybody's able to get their voices heard. You don't always get what you want. Again, the polarized outcomes are generally not common, but at least it's something that's very acceptable and comfortable for both sides. So I find that the expression of our current resident generation is beneficial because I think they bring a lot of really good ideas to the table. But understanding and guiding them and mentoring them really about the experiences that we face as faculty becomes really important, so that, again, it gives voice to their concerns, it brings resolution that both are satisfied with, and it's a form of development personally and from a leadership perspective as well. So I think if you approach things that way, you actually have multiple benefits.
Mona, I feel like you've probably been in similar situations. Do you have anything to add to those comments? That was really useful insight from Nina.
Yeah, I'm listening intently and nodding my head throughout. It's very heartwarming to hear you speak, because we deal with this on almost every day basis, and it's very difficult taking decisions and making choices that can influence a whole department. So I'm really very keen on learning more. So we do have a few more questions. I wish this can actually last even longer, but I know you have a limited time with us too. One point for CS that's very important is equity, diversity, and inclusion. And I was wondering if you can address these issues as a team. How do you manage with your organization and with your healthcare providers? How do you deal with EDI nowadays?
EDI is an area of interest of mine, most definitely. I was involved in a couple of major initiatives at ACUPO, where we were looking at EDI in the CARMS interview process as an example. EDI is, to me, it's a policy and an entity that we have to be very careful with, because it's almost as though we need to bring attention to this, but we also don't want to go so far that it becomes like a reverse EDI situation. And I say that because we see policies in place, and a lot of them in organizations are there to guide and not necessarily followed. And it becomes the tick box that, oh, yes, we've addressed this. So that you have people and positions that have the representation, which is excellent, but the true culture hasn't changed. And so that the face of it may appear one way, but the internal workings have not really shifted. So that it can be a disservice when, okay, you have the faces around the table, but do they really still have a voice? And I think in a lot of organizations, they do, but in a lot of organizations, they still don't. And so that's where I feel we need to really be careful about how we approach it to ensure that we go to the depth that we really need to be going to in EDI. My perspective on it fundamentally is it's about respect. We need to be able to respect one another. We need to be able to be open to hearing each other's voices. It doesn't matter if it's coming from someone who's green or someone who's purple or someone who's orange or whatever that is. It fundamentally comes down to respect. However, we also need to understand what our own innate biases are, conscious and subconscious. And a lot of those things come from our own personal experiences along the journey. So that if we have an opportunity to actually work through them and identify that, so we know what lens we're looking through, as we were talking about before, people view circumstances, situations, and experiences through their own lens. If we actually can identify what those lenses are for us, we can then really, truly look at EDI from a respect standpoint and see, okay, what do I need to work on? What concerns do I have? How can I help support someone else? Where am I polarized? Where do I need to be balanced? And then how can I support and challenge others to do the same? And there's a skill in that, and there's a self-awareness that needs to be developed for that, which I think is really key, and which I hope to develop in people that I work with.
Nina, what are your thoughts about why EDI is being challenged more, you know, in recent months than it was prior to that?
I believe EDI is being challenged because if you look at the extremes, and I've been using the word polarity or polarization a lot this evening as well, we were at one point where voices were not being heard nearly as much as they should be. And now we're approaching a position where voices are really being heard, and some voices are really being heard, but there are other voices now that were heard before that aren't being heard so much. So it's almost as though if you think of a positive side and a negative side, you know, we started on one end and then we're swinging to the other. And so then you're getting emotional responses from the side that is now on the side that was being heard. And so they're calling out for things being brought back to neutral. So I think that's where I talk about that whole reverse EDI concept, is that we need EDI. We need to be focusing on all of those issues, but we need to be very mindful that the voices that are the allies who are not of the underrepresented groups or the minoritized groups, that they are still being heard as well as they are empowering those of us who are of those groups that need to be brought to the table more. That's my view on why I think that there's a little bit of backlash on that. And I think that we need to step in and really be mindful and aware and proactive about ensuring that we don't go to the other end of the spectrum when it comes to polarity, and that we really are bringing things into balance. But sometimes it takes that. It's kind of, I always give the example of Madonna. Madonna for women was like, you know, she took sexuality and went to such an extreme that suddenly it made it okay to talk about things sometimes, whereas it was such a different thing for women at one point. So it's almost, and then, you know, things kind of come to the middle a little bit. So I'm hoping that that's what's going to happen with EDI. I bet you never thought we'd talk about Madonna in this conversation.
We definitely were not expecting that tonight.
Yeah.
Can you tell us more about how you maintain resilience and attempt to prevent burnout in the various high-pressure leadership roles that you've held?
For me, it's really about trying to stay grounded. I'm very fortunate to have a really wonderful support network, a very supportive husband, very supportive parents, and our family is very much about bringing up the best in each other. And so that's something that is just a fundamental principle in what we do. That is a huge source of support for me and something that keeps me very grounded. I think also being able to stop, pause, and assess, what am I doing? Where am I feeling aligned? Where am I feeling misaligned? Where am I feeling stretched? What is being compromised by my doing X, Y, Z? What am I feeling stress about? Where do I feel chaos is existing in my life? And then where do I need to balance? So for example, if we look at professional and family, those are often at odds. So the more we work, the less time we have for our family. If I'm feeling like I'm very engaged in my work and I'm feeling guilty because I don't have time to spend with my family, well, then that to me is a clue that something's got to give at work so that I can rebalance between professional or vocational and family. It's hard to do that, though, because we are so busy and we're on the treadmill and work is demanding. But it's really about having to make a decision and say that these hours are protected time no matter what. You cannot disturb it. This is going to be for my family and this is going to be for my work. And so you do time blocking, you do different techniques to be able to manage your time. But I think, again, underlying all of that, though, is having that awareness of what are my core values? What is the most important thing to me? And I think in the hustle and bustle of everything that we do, we get lost in the momentum of it all. And you can very easily lose yourself in all of that. So that it's very important to have those touch points to be able to take a look at what's happening in your world and to then decide what's out of balance and what needs to be rebalanced. And that's a constant work in progress. I'm not perfect at it either. I'm, you know, in my determining that, okay, I need to really step back my practice. That's because I had hit such a level of chaos and I was feeling like, okay, you know, I'm not able to enjoy my family the way that I want to, something has to change. That's really what, you know, made such a strong pivot. And then again, circumstances around me just followed through and supported it so that I knew it was the right move for me.
What's really interesting about the way you answer that, Nina, typically the answer to that question is, you know, exercise, walk, you know, connect with nature, meditate, sleep well, all of which are phenomenal approaches to, you know, preventing burnout. But what's clear to me is that the core of your approach to this is making sure that you're, you know, where you're allocating time is aligned with your core values. And so that's just, it's a great way to think about this. I mean, your answers might still include all the things that I said, meditation, but it's through the lens of, you know, what are your core values and how can you make sure that you're aligning your time allocation with your core values? So thanks for sharing that perspective, which I think is different than the typical answer to burnout prevention. So thank you.
No problem. And I think a good way to think of it is, and this is, one of my mentors or one of my coaches in the realm of docs and leadership has shared with me, is there's a difference between a tactic and a strategy. So that the tactics support the strategy. The strategy is to be in alignment. The tactics are things like meditation, yoga, and all the things that we mentioned. So that, you know, in the work that I do through docs and leadership, it's really about let's work on the strategy and let's pull together, you know, mental performance, and let's pull in emotional intelligence, let's pull in leadership development and wellness development and all of those things. So it's a different way of thinking that I think brings lasting change. And that's what I've seen in, you know, people that I've mentored and worked with, and just in my own life as well.
It's impressive how you can decorticate every aspect. It's really wonderful to hear you talk and to learn from you. In leadership roles, we do have a lot of stressors too. And for example, having a position where you manage a hospital or a program, sometimes the impact of healthcare policy and regulation takes a toll. Can you speak about that? Can we discuss that a bit more?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think that that's a real issue and a real challenge right now for healthcare leaders. So if we first look at the difference between a policy and a regulation, and you know this, but I'll just do a quick recap just to introduce what my thoughts are on it. Policy is really about the goals and frameworks to a certain end, versus a regulation is really the rules and standards around something. So an example of a regulation would be licensing requirements. An example of a policy would be Doug Ford and his policy to expand private centers for cataract surgery. I think that there's a huge impact, clearly, on policy, particularly if we use the example of Doug Ford and the expansion of surgical centers for cataract surgery. That is a very polarizing policy, especially when you put it against the policy of the Canada Health Act, which is all about accessible care that's, you know, universal and comprehensive and available to all and publicly administered, et cetera. So the idea gets to be, if you've got these policies that are coming out that are dividing people, how do you navigate that? How do you bring people together? That's a huge challenge. And with resources becoming more and more restricted, emotions are getting higher. So then how do you settle emotions so that we can actually have rational conversations? Because there are always people on both sides of the fence. There's always going to be people who feel like, oh, this is a great idea. This is fantastic. I'm loving this. I'm in the private space. This is wonderful. And then there are people in the public space where it's like, what are you doing? You're charging people exorbitant amounts of money, and this is crazy. And whether or not that's true, that's a whole other thing. But the perception on both sides becomes a very big challenge to balance. And then throw in academia. Where are we going to teach our learners? How are we going to expose them? What standards do we want to uphold? How do we implement that? And how do we standardize things so that we're making sure that our learners are learning what we want them to learn with the ethics and everything else that we want to ingrain in them? So that I feel that the skill, again, it comes back to that self-awareness, knowing what your triggers are, knowing where you're polarized, understanding the origins of those polarities, and then how is that the experience? What is the experience for the other person? And understanding that other person's experience, and then how can we learn from each other and understand each other's perspectives and come together with something that's actually going to be in alignment with the policies that are set forth, in alignment with the regulations that are set forth, but also in a way that we're not feeling this internal chaos, whether it be us as individuals or us as colleagues. Because right now, the reality is, and the truth of the matter is, some of us are divided, and it's really sad. And I think it works against us at so many levels. So again, a policy like that is dividing us. So then how do we advocate for our profession publicly when we're divided from within? And when the public You know, there was the CBC report by a patient recently, you must have heard, where she was very dissatisfied with her experience at a private center. So when I heard that, I thought, okay, well, we really need to work on educating the public, because there are private centers, there are differences between private and public, and there are reasons for those differences. And unless they're communicated in a way that can resonate and speak to our patients, there's always going to be this perception of gouging. How many of our colleagues they're upset with us? You guys make so much money. This is, you know, this is XYZ. And it's not just with ophthalmology, it's with other subspecialties as well. But we need to be able to talk about it. And some people say to me, you know, Nina, you talk about things that nobody wants to talk about. Well, we need to, because we're never going to come to a solution, right? So I bring that up. And I do believe that there are ways to come together. Will it be easy? Absolutely not. Will it be quick? Absolutely not. Is it possible? Yes, I believe so. But I think it's a lot of work that needs to be done on both sides of the fence, where we're really looking internally to find that alignment. And then again, that place where we can feel balanced enough so that both sides are relatively satisfied.
You talked earlier about your evolving priorities as a leader, and initially, you know, focusing on almost like a ladder of leadership and various accomplishments, accolades and experiences, and transitioning towards legacy. And I, you know, nobody wants to talk about death, but like the eulogy, the idea of, you know, preparing for a eulogy that would make you proud at the end of one's life. And so I'm wondering if you can share more about what your ideal impact would be on the field as a leader, and what legacy you'll leave.
For myself, in my career so far, I feel very privileged to have had the career that I've had so far. And the impact that I've had on the people that I've been able to work with and mentor, to me, has been very, very meaningful. In this shift in my career to moving into docs and leadership, what I would love to see is for the ideas of enhancing mental performance that's based in increasing your self-awareness and emotional intelligence, such that it allows people to be their best as a provider, as a leader, as a family person, in a way that maintains their well-being. That would be huge for me. Like if I could really get this out there and impact people on a broad scale, where this just becomes part of who we are in medicine, that would be really meaningful to me. Because I think that as healthcare providers and physicians, surgeons, whatever healthcare profession you're in, our intention truly is to help people. And I think the tendency in that altruism is to really neglect ourselves, so that to be able to bring the balance between the altruistic side and looking out for ourselves as well, I believe will bring out the best in us, so that we can be very mindful, objective, reasonable, grounded in what we're doing, so that we're able to be there for our families, we're able to feel that inner satisfaction, we're able to contribute to our profession, we're able to contribute to our society, and we're able to just optimize people's health and give each other space to, you know, you have a great idea, go for it. I want to support you. I don't want to compete against you. We've been raised in this culture of competition through our careers, throughout our entire journeys. I'd love for us to be able to pull back from that and really truly be able to support each other and celebrate all areas of our life, all aspects of our life, through this work that really is about increasing your self-awareness fundamentally and being in alignment with who you are. If I could bring that to our medical education systems and our healthcare systems, it's a grand mission, but even if I get like a little tiny centimeter along the path and somebody else takes it from there, like, I'm okay with that. But if I can at least get the thought processes going, I would be very, very grateful.
I think, Nina, you already have brought it forth. And I think in Canada, we do recognize you as a great physician leader. And we owe you a lot of this knowledge. And the delivery is just exceptional. The way you present it, you've presented at many departments throughout the country and now on the podcast, and you always give these webinars that are very enlightening. So although you wish to have that legacy, I think that legacy is already existing. And we all recognize Dr. Naina Ahuja and for her leadership roles. So thank you for that, honestly. It's really
Thank you. That means so much to me. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
We do have one last question. As you've already been on the podcast, I'm sure we've asked you in the past. Can you share with us how you spend your time outside of leadership roles, outside of the healthcare field? How do you occupy your time? Do you have any hobbies? How many children do you have? Mm-hmm. I'd love to know.
Sure. So I'm very blessed to have a wonderful husband who is someone I really enjoy spending a lot of time with. He's very funny, and he makes me laugh, and he always corrects my phrases because I often get colloquial phrases incorrect. So I have two lovely daughters. I'm a bonus mom. So when Michael and I got married, he brought along with him these two beautiful daughters who I've known since they were 4 and 7, and they're lovely. So I enjoy spending time with them. My parents live close by. I love spending time with them. I have a nephew and brother. So family is really important to me. So I really love to spend a lot of time with family. We enjoy traveling as well, which is nice. We don't often have opportunities to do so, just with the pandemic, of course. And it's almost like we forget how to arrange vacations. So we're working on that for this summer. Traveling is another thing. I love to sketch. I love to write. I love to listen to different podcasts, and I love actually watching a lot of the Netflix specials on leadership and development. So, for example, I was watching recently the Hillary Clinton series. I thought that was really interesting. There's another series called Live to Lead, which talks about the journey of Gloria Steinem, for example. Just various people who really had an impact. I love hearing their journeys and listening to their lessons they've learned. And so to me, things like that offer some growth and relaxation. We also like watching stand-up comedy specials and going to the theater, things like that. So there's a nice balance, I feel, and I'm hoping that going to the gym will be something that becomes more of a routine. So we have aspirations of various things as well. Cooking together more, hopefully. So it's a work in progress, like I said, but it's something that definitely I feel very fortunate to have a really beautiful, supportive family and opportunities to experience different things. So I feel very blessed and many good friends as well. So
that's wonderful. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, Naina, this has been so enlightening, and thank you for sharing many things you've learned. It's been wonderful for me, and I can see from Mona's smile how much she's learned as well, and I think our listeners will really benefit from this. I apologize for putting you on the spot a few times, but I just feel like there's too much to learn, and I'll take this opportunity to ask you a little bit more pointed questions. So once again, thank you on behalf of the ICANN podcast and the COS, and on behalf of all our listeners, and really for everything you're doing for leadership and ophthalmology and beyond. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. And I was very happy to answer any questions. So thanks for engaging in that discussion.
ICANN wants to know what you think. Please send your comments on today's episode or any suggestions you may have for topics or features to communications@cos-sco.ca. And we will try to incorporate them into future episodes. Season 4 of the ICANN podcast is brought to you by Bayer Ophthalmology. We thank them for their support.
Nous aimerions remercier Bayer Ophthalmology pour leur support de la 4e saison du balado ICANN. Thank you from the Canadian Ophthalmological Society.
ICANN is written and directed by Kim Teitler and produced by John Allaire from Allaire Strategic Works.
ICANN is available on Apple, Spotify, and Google platforms, and of course, through the COS Practice Resource Center.
Some episodes this season will include relevant links and show notes, so be sure to check episode descriptions to learn more.
Thank you for joining us this week. We look forward to bringing you more episodes.